Are you ready?
Yep.
The CMU podcast in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Pandora, Mega Upload, Measuring Music, and Justin Bieber. I'm Andy Malt, editor of CMU. In a slightly different, slightly upsetting configuration of the studio this week that is confusing and scary. But still on the other side of the table is Chris Cook.
I'm sort of around the table rather than on the other side of the table in this
configuration. Well, we're on the same table this week, and what's upsetting me.
I quite like it.
You're touching my table, I don't like it.
I have a good feeling about this configuration. I think this is going to be a particularly fine edition of the podcast because of the configuration.
What's really upsetting is that your table is still in the studio.
And not being used.
I can see it, but you're not sat at it.
It's true. But there you go. So
anyway, you've been doing a lot of stuff this week.
It's been a very busy week. Talk about that. Busy week. We had the CMU Insights seminar on Monday. That was very good. That's me talking for 2 hours, so that's a bit egotistical me saying it's very good. I can say that my panels at the Community Festival were very good, because that's not me. That's my panelists, and they were brilliant. So Community, new showcase festival taking place in Shoreditch this week, as we speak, not as you listen to this. As you listen to this, it's over. Sorry, but it was great. And we did some CMU Insight sessions. One on playlists, which was a topic we covered at The Great Escape in detail. But a lot's changed, a lot's evolved. So it was great to have a catch-up on that. And then YouTube, but not music on YouTube. The YouTube universe, which is something we're going to be covering quite a bit in our events over the next few months, I feel. So that was that. Then I did the Tech Pitch Music 4.5. That's not what it's called.
No, you probably want to say that as it is.
The Music Tech Pitch 4.5, which I've never even been to before. And I was judging. And that was very interesting. Six, seven, eight. Eight startups pitching their ideas. So
good ones?
Any? Well, they vote. So we, the judges, vote, and the audience votes, and we voted for the same things.
And what was it?
The winner, I think I'm right in saying, the winner was basically a platform where you can put together. So an artist could go on, upload their music, and then pull in bits of video from their phone, pull in bits of video from a library of video stuff, and create a music video, and then it will then spit it out so you can put it on YouTube. It costs £20, and it's really easy to use, blah, blah, blah.
Great, that sounds pointless. So let's talk about Pandora.
So a winning startup there.
Yeah, talk of winning startups. Bit of breaking news on the podcast this week, because it has pretty much just been announced as we record on Thursday.
You're calling Pandora a winning startup?
Yeah.
They are neither a startup nor winning.
They're
very big.
Given that we work in an office populated by startups, one thing I've learned in the last year is that anything could be called a startup.
So you think Pandora's a startup?
Pandora's a startup.
It's winning in terms of, actually, if you take YouTube
floated
and SoundCloud out of the equation, it is the biggest streaming service in the world, even though it's only available in 3 countries. So it's winning in that respect. It just continues to be loss-making 12 years after its launch. But hey,
need to make money to be a success.
In tech, profit doesn't seem to have anything
money.
To do with being a success.
It's about being happy.
So Pandora is in the news.
Yes, Pandora has done an unprecedented licensing deal with Sony ATV.
Except that it's actually a precedented
deal.
Yeah,
no. The specific terms of the deal are confidential, so we don't know exactly how it's unprecedented. But it does look very similar to one they did a year ago with BMG.
You nearly said a decade ago then. I could see you about to say decade.
I nearly said Adele.
You said Adele? What has Adele got to do with this?
Adele's got just on my mind.
How has Adele ended up in our copyright story of the week? She's everywhere.
Yeah. You can't escape.
Bloody
from
Adele. Go away. We're talking about Pandora.
We are. Anyway, so what we do know is this is a multi-year licensing agreement for Sony ATV's catalogue.
So this is a direct deal between Sony ATV, the world's biggest music publisher, and Pandora.
But Chris Cook, I thought under US law that publishers couldn't do direct deals.
So this is the interesting thing. So Pandora
at
the moment...
Which we already know from the BMG deal, but anyway.
Anyway, I'm going to answer the question.
Yeah.
Because you've asked it,
yeah.
Even though we know it's a redundant question. So let's backtrack ever so slightly. Pandora, personalised radio service in the US, biggest streaming service in the US, and actually, as I say, unless you count YouTube and SoundCloud, it's the biggest streaming service in the world. And Pandora predominantly licenses the song copyrights through the collective licensing system, which in the US is BMI and ASCAP, and then there's CSAC, and there's then whatever that Warren Irving has off set up. Global Music something.
Right.
So All of the song licensing is covered by collective licensing system through the collecting societies, and that is how it has been set up. However, once you start doing your deals through the collective licensing system, ultimately, the licensee, i.e. Pandora, if they're not happy with the terms that you are offering them as a publisher, can take you to a court. Because collective licensing throws up competition law concerns, copyright systems say, OK, you can license collectively, but if people can't agree terms on rates, then there will be a system. So in the UK, we call it copyright tribunal. In the US, I think it's called rate court. And so Pandora...
Rate court sounds a lot more exciting.
Well, there you go. So Pandora can take and has taken BMI and ASCAP to the rate court and ask for lower royalties. And so Pandora has been doing this over the years, always trying to put the royalties down. And the publishers don't like that. And the publishers don't like the fact that ultimately the rate courts are setting the money that they're getting from Pandora and they feel they're not getting enough money. And so this has been brewing for a while. And a few years ago, Sony ATV and Universal Music Publishing, the two biggest music publishers in the world, both decided, you know what? We're sick to death of this. If we pull our digital rights out of the collective licensing system, so we no longer allow BMI and ASCAP, etc., to license Pandora, we'll start doing direct deals. And the minute we start doing direct deals, we no longer have the fear of being taken to rate court. We can basically hold them to ransom and say, you either agree to these terms or you don't get our songs. And then we'll get better rates. And they, Pandora, fearing that this was going to happen, did do some deals and they agreed better rates. We know that they were going to get better rates under this. However, at the same time as negotiating those deals, Pandora went to the rate courts and said to the judge, we think that under the rules that govern collective licensing here in the US, Sony and Universal shouldn't be allowed to do this. With collective licensing under the current rules in America, you're either in or you're out. So either you license everything collectively or you license nothing collectively. There can't be, oh, we'll license live collectively, we'll license radio collectively, but we won't license digital collectively. Whereas here in Europe, the rules are quite specific that you can do some things collectively and some things not collectively when it comes to the performing rights of the copyright. The system allows you to take digital out, but keep radio and live in. So Pandora went to court and said, you shouldn't be allowed to do that in the US, and the judge agreed. And the judge said, yeah, you're right. They shouldn't be allowed to just pull digital rights. So then Sony and Universal were faced with the prospect that if they pulled their digital rights out of BMI and ASCAP, they would have to pull everything.
So they'd have to do a direct deal with every little bar.
Exactly.
In the US.
And although Marty Bandier, who runs Sony ATV, sort of implied that ultimately he would do that, I mean, I don't think he would. I mean, it would be a nightmare to have to license every single little company that makes use of music across the US. And so it's all been in limbo. And so what Sony and Universal have been doing ever since is trying to persuade the Department of Justice, which controls collective licensing rules in the US, to change the rules and to basically adopt the system that we have in Europe, where digital can be pulled out without everything else. That's all currently being reviewed. We're expecting, I mean, actually, possibly this side of Christmas, we're expecting the Department of Justice to come forward with the way it's going to rejig collective licensing rules. They're called consent decrees for some reason. And so the reform of the consent decrees, we're expecting the Department of Justice to come out with a list of reforms quite soon. And most people think that partial withdrawal, the flexibility to be able to pull digital out of collective licensing without pulling everything else, will be part of the review. However, although the publishers under the current system are obliged to license streaming services through the collective licensing system, if that is what the streaming service wants, the streaming service is not obliged to license through the collecting societies. So it's a one-way obligation. So Pandora can choose to go to BMG or Sony ATV and do a direct deal, which actually is different than it is over here in Europe. Over here in Europe, actually, there isn't usually that flexibility. It's either we're doing it through PRS and that's the way it's done, or we're not doing it for societies and we will negotiate directly. So actually, that's where you have some flexibility in the US that we don't have over here.
So it is, in fact, this is Pandora going to Sony ATV and not the other way around, despite the fact that Pandora complained about Sony wanting to do it the other way.
Yes, so if you can convince the digital service that it is in their interest to do a direct deal, then whether or not that's Pandora going and saying, OK, perhaps there's something we can do here, or it's Sony going, well, come on, let's do a deal. If you can persuade the digital service to do the direct deal, then the direct deal can be done. And that's what BMG did a year ago, and that is what Sony ATV have now done. Now, you would usually assume the only reason why Pandora would choose to do the deal is if they're getting better rates. And so we know that on the sound recording side, where you have Sound Exchange, the same rules apply, that the labels have to license through Sound Exchange, but the digital service can circumvent Sound Exchange and go and do a direct deal if they wish. They did a direct deal with Merlin, who represents lots of indie labels, and Pandora got a slightly better deal off Merlin. Providing they use a certain quantity of Merlin members' content, then they start to get a bit of a discount.
And there was all sorts of, offering kind of marketing tools to the indie labels to make it a sweeter deal for them.
Exactly. So, but ultimately, Pandora will save a little bit of money providing a certain quantity of indie label content is used. Yeah. So that is why it was in Pandora's interest. We have the marketing tools. We're willing to give them to you. Doesn't really cost us any money. Plus, we'll get a slight discount on the royalties once we reach a certain quantity. So normally, when you get a direct deal, the assumption is you've given Pandora a slightly better rate, possibly in return for some marketing benefits. And we suspect that that's what the BMG deal was, although we don't, as with all of these direct deals, you never know the specifics. What Sony ATV are saying is that they are getting a better deal, and they're certainly implying that it's not just marketing benefits. And there is the issue. Sony ATV is so bloody big. I mean, they are the biggest music publisher in the world. How could you offer marketing benefits to Sony ATV? Because now you're offering marketing benefits to the biggest publisher, the biggest part repertoire. And all, as we've said before, with the Merlin Sound Exchange deal, if you offer marketing benefits to everybody, well then those marketing benefits are worthless because nobody has the advantage. So there's an implication here that actually, in fact, it might even, this is so breaking news.
It does say, yes, Sony ATV achieved its goal of delivering improved performance royalties for its songwriters, while Pandora will benefit from a greater rate certainty and the ability to add new flexibility to the company's product offering over time.
So there you see. So what this deal is, so I suppose in that respect, I don't know the specifics of the BMG deal, but this possibly is unprecedented in that Pandora have voluntarily done this deal, paying slightly higher rate than they would through BMI and ASCAP. So why the hell would they do that? Well, I think two things. A, that suggests to me that Pandora are pretty certain that the Department of Justice reform of consent decree is going to allow partial withdrawal. Yeah. So they're sort of preempting what's going to happen inevitably anyway. And B, there is the advantage of taking it out of the collective licensing system, taking it out of the rate courts. You can do a commercial deal. The commercial deal can last for longer. It's less open to the whims of collective licensing. And I think at the moment, probably what Pandora are looking to do, given that there's been a bit of wobbling on their share price, there have been investors sort of questioning what's happening there, is to be able to go to their investors and say, we have our deals all structured, everybody's happy, the rates, okay, they might be slightly higher than they used to be, but we've not got big legal battles ahead, we're not going to get bad PR around trying to get the rates down. We can now just go and market for the next 2 or 3 years rather than having these constant battles and PR disasters around royalties. So I guess that's probably what Pandora are getting out of this, rather than a better rate, which is what you would usually have expected them to be getting from direct deals previously.
Yeah, though as nice as that sounds, it does raise quite a lot of questions about how exactly this is going to work, because it's not as easy as just cutting the collecting society out of the equation.
No, from Sony's side, I think if I was a Sony-signed songwriter, the statement that's been put out, beyond the specifics of the deal, is how is this working on the publisher's side? Because as you say, it isn't just as easy as saying, right, OK, BMI and ASCAP are no longer part of this. There's two issues here, which is A, when money moves through the collective licensing system, through BMI and ASCAP, the societies automatically pay 50% of the royalties to the songwriters. That money never goes to the publishers, it goes direct to the songwriters. So if money is no longer running through BMI and ASCAP, how are the songwriters getting their money? Is Sony going to start paying that money? Will it pay it through the society? And there was talk back when it looked like the big publishers might go the direct licensing route before, there was talk of actually the money still going through BMI and ASCAP and the songwriters still getting their half directly, but it would be done at the Sony agreed rate rather than the BMI ASCAP rate. But I don't know whether any of that was ever actually worked out or set up. So there's the whole issue, well, how does this work? What does it mean for Sony and Sony songwriters? Also, does this apply to all Sony catalogue or just Sony's US catalogue? I suspect it's the latter, because bearing in mind here we're talking about the performing rights of the song, and with Pandora it's only the performing rights. Mechanical rights don't come into it with Pandora. And in Europe, the Sony ATV doesn't control the performing rights. The songs that they own the copyright in, they own all of the copyright except the performing rights. So here in the UK, PRS controls the performing rights of songs, even though those songs have been published by Sony ATV, and when it comes to sync and mechanicals, Sony does control the song. So you can't pull the UK repertoire out without PRS's involvement. So what we don't know is, is this deal just for US repertoire and international repertoire will continue to go through the societies, or is there going to be some complicated arrangement between PRS and Sony and BMI and ASCAP and blah, blah, blah. So it is an interesting development. Actually, you know, with hindsight, it would be good to dig and work out quite how the BMG arrangement has been working, because I remember talking to them at the time when they announced it. It was a little bit vague about how it was going to work. I don't know how things have developed in the last year. It may well be that there is a bit of precedent set there that Sony ATV will now copy.
No, this is unprecedented.
Of course it's unprecedented. So therefore, who knows? So I think if you're a Sony ATV songwriter, whether you're in the US or the UK, whether you're a PRS member or a BMI ASCAP member, it's an interesting development. Ultimately, Marty Brandy would definitely say, we've got higher rates. You're going to get more money.
Yes.
But quite how it's going to work, God knows. And it will be interesting to see how that is developed and communicated. It may well need part two, or part three. There's already going to be a part two of Dissecting the Digital Dollar. Perhaps we'll need a part three of Dissecting the Digital Dollar just to explain how this is going to work, because I imagine it could end up being quite complicated.
Well, that's something to look forward to. And now, with apologies to Tom, who would like us to stop reporting on this, the Mega Upload extradition hearing.
We haven't talked about Mega Upload and Kim.com for a few weeks now. We may have done in the sort of one-liners bit, but we've not given it some full-on conversation time.
No, and it's about time, because actually something's happened this week, which is quite unusual for the Mega Upload case.
It is. So, quick recap on the old Mega Upload story. Mega Upload, the file transfer service, shut down
January 2012.
So nearly 4 years ago.
Yeah.
Now, and Kim.com, the founder, and some of the other guys who ran it are accused by the US government when the business was live of racketeering, money laundering, and copyright infringement.
It's like rampant copyright infringement.
Well, I think that's my use of the word rampant. I don't think that's
actually... I think rampant is a legal term.
In the extradition papers, they've used the word rampant. So that's the criminal allegations that Kim.com and his former colleagues face. But they are living in New Zealand. The Americans have now been trying to extradite. I mean, they filed the extradition papers almost as soon as Mega Upload was shut down four years ago. And originally it was going to be, oh, this will take 6 months to go through the process of the extradition. Oh, God, it's going to take us 6 months to extradite the guy. And here we are 4 years later. And it's only really just starting. And the extradition hearing was postponed and postponed and postponed for all sorts of tedious technicality reasons.
Yes, the defence lawyers representing Kim.com et al. Basically, their procedures to date have been to delay and postpone this hearing.
And indeed, when the hearing kicked off, we're in November now, so early last month in October. First of all, before the hearing had even started, the defence team went in and said, we don't think this should be happening. These are the reasons why it shouldn't be happening.
And in fact, the prosecution delivered its case, finished, was it last month?
Yeah,
I think.
In a few days.
And the defence case did not immediately begin because they had another go at delaying and postponing.
Yeah, so before the case had even begun, we should delay. Judge said no. Day one, they said, we don't think this should be happening. Delay. Judge said no. Prosecution then very quickly delivered their case. That was all over in a few days. And said, OK, defence, give your case. And then they spent 3 weeks saying, no, we shouldn't be doing this, shouldn't be doing this, shouldn't be doing this. And then last week, finally, the judge said, oh, for God's sake, we've had that conversation. We're doing this. Because, I mean, if this goes against you, there's still an appeal process down the line. So it's not like this is the last chance saloon. And so finally on Monday, they were said, will you stop talking about delaying the extradition hearing and actually give us your arguments against what the prosecution said, even though none of us can remember what the prosecution said because we've just spent 3 weeks on all of this delaying nonsense. But we have had, finally this week, the defence in the Mega Upload case presenting their arguments against the claims of the American government. And most of these complaints have been risen before, but actually, because most of the Mega Upload legal shenanigans have been technicalities and delays and all of that stuff, I think it probably was the first time that the defence team presented in bullet points, these are our arguments against the core case that the American government has so far provided.
Yes, so Mega Upload's lawyer Ron Mansfield got up this week and said, here's the thing. Well, the key bit of evidence, which we've discussed many times before, certainly in print, if not out loud, is that there were conversations had between Kim.com and his team where they seemed to reference the fact that they were aware what they were doing is legal. They referred to themselves as modern-day pirates.
And the when the prosecution were presenting last month, they brought out all these quotes, didn't they, where they were saying, oh, Kim.com said, oh, my God, if a judge ever finds out what we're up to, we're screwed, and all of that sort of stuff. A whole list of quotes from these various Skype conversations or email conversations were presented, and they did portray Kim.com and his former colleagues in a bad light. But
Mansfield says that these conversations have been cherry-picked from huge reams of conversations had between these people, and they've picked out quotes that make them look bad. He also said that some of the conversations were carried out in German, which is Kim.com's native language.
Kim Schmidt, before he changed his name.
.com's not his real name.
No, surprisingly.
We could have guessed. The prosecution has translated these things from German in a way that makes him look bad, is what the lawyer's basically saying.
They then entered in the old safe harbour defence.
The classic.
Which we were expecting, which basically was saying, OK, there may have been copyright infringement on the Mega Upload platform, but US and New Zealand law have these safe harbours that say that if you're providing the tools for other people and they use them to infringe, providing you have a takedown system in place, then you can't be held liable. And then he was sort of wielding out and saying, if you hold Mega Upload liable, and bearing in mind, this is a criminal case. It's not even civil liabilities. If you hold Mega Upload liable, then Google will be liable, then Facebook will be liable, and Twitter will be liable, and really sort of hammering home the safe harbours thing. And we're just the same as them. We're just the same.
That's the defence that always gets wheeled out in these things and has never worked. He did also say, however, that while a service like this would be covered by safe harbour rules in both New Zealand and the US, he said that that copyright infringement isn't covered by New Zealand and US extradition agreement. So,
yes.
So therefore, Kim.com and its execs should not be extradited on those grounds. Although the prosecution then pointed out that they're also up for fraud, and that is covered.
But the key point there is, how do you define... Yeah, they were arguing that it wasn't fraud. So you're right. Point one, you misrepresented us in the quotes. Point two, safe harbours. But even if you think there was copyright infringement, which we don't, copyright infringement isn't covered by the extradition treaty. And so, yeah, is the copyright infringement fraud or not? And then they were sort of wheeling out precedent from both. I think they both had American cases and New Zealand cases where judges had specifically said, we cannot classify copyright infringement as fraud. So that, I think, in terms of the specifics of the extradition case, when it comes to the charges against them, the copyright infringement charges, then it is, we've been misrepresented, safe harbours, that is the core case. If this was ever to get to an American court, that would be the argument. But you're right, for the actual extradition case, the crucial thing is, this is all about copyright infringement, and that shouldn't be covered by the extradition hearing. So the job of the prosecution is to convince the judge that there is a case for fraud here, and that therefore it should be covered by the extradition. The other thing that happened was, after comparing Mega Upload to Google and Facebook, Twitter, obviously what the prosecution are trying to do is say Mega Upload was nothing like those people. Those are legitimate companies. We have business relationships with them. Mega Upload were much more, a sort of dodgy concern is what they're now saying. And then the lawyer bloke for the defence was trying to say, no, hang on a second. With hindsight, you're portraying Mega Upload as if it was some shady organisation, but it was a legitimate company. And look at all these pop stars who backed it. And to prove that actually it was a legitimate company with lots of mainstream pop star support, they wheeled out your favourite, the old Mega song.
Yeah, I think I would have extradited them on the spot the moment that was played.
And so the lawyer started playing the Mega song, and then the judge said, I don't think we need to hear this. I don't see why this is relevant.
It doesn't matter, he's heard it now. It's going to be in his head for the next 10 years.
Don't play the Mega song in my bloody courtroom. So those are the arguments that have been presented so far this week. As we record this, I think the defence is still going through the motions, although we were expecting them, actually, now they've finally got round to actually are answering the case, to be done quite quickly. I don't know how quickly it will then take for the judge to decide whether or not he's going to extradite .com et al. Although, even if he decides to extradite them, there is an appeal process. So even if the prosecution win, and it's a hard one to call, I think that on that point you raised, are we classifying copyright infringement as fraud? But ultimately, at this stage, that's what it all hangs on. And I don't know which way it will go. But even if it does go in the prosecution's favour, or indeed the defence's favour, there's an appeals process to come. So this is not going to be the end of even this first chapter. And if they do get extradited, then there's probably 8 years of wrangling and delays and litigation to come in the American courts before they get .com in jail.
I mean, We always said this was going to take a long time. I don't think we ever thought it would take this long.
And of course, you know, I mean, ultimately, if they can't extradite him, then I suppose they could try certainly suing through the New Zealand courts. Whether or not they could pursue a criminal prosecution, I don't know. So I suppose even if they don't get extradited, there probably is more litigation to come. Of course, the record industries and the movie studios are also suing .com and his former colleagues. So that's, in addition to the criminal action, there is civil litigation that is sort of on hold while the criminal case goes through the motions. So plenty more of this to come. Tom will be pleased to hear.
Yes.
He's almost certainly... We should mention who Tom is. Not Tom from MySpace. It's Tom who works on some research and marketing for us here at CMU and doesn't appreciate all of the dot-com chatter on the podcast. But I'm afraid I'm almost certain there'll be more to come, and there may be more to come next week, because I suspect we might have a judgment on this in the next 7 days.
So something for everyone to look forward to there.
CMU approved time now on the CMU podcast.
It is.
And why don't you tell us why tricot, is that how we're going to pronounce it?
No.
Tricot?
No.
Tricot?
No.
How are we pronouncing this?
I'm going to give you one more guess and then I'll tell you.
I don't really see how else you could say it.
Oh, there is another way.
Is there? What did I say? I said tricot,
yep.
Tricot,
yep.
Tricot.
Yep.
Trisot.
No, unfortunately, you lose. It is trico.
Trico.
Because it's a French word.
It's a French word from this Japanese artist.
Yeah, your favourite French-named bands who are not French.
Well, there you go. Some people would think that before we did this part of the podcast, we might talk through how we pronounce the names. But anyway.
I think we did talk about doing that once, but I find it funnier to make you pronounce names.
Try and work out how the hell you pronounce these. Well, actually, Kelly Lee Owens' Club 8, Jupiter Sounds, I think I've got over the hurdle already.
No, you got two of those wrong.
Did I?
Yeah.
Well, I look forward to...
Trico!
Trico!
A Japanese math rock trio who are very good. They released a new album.
Called... They've got a stupid name. But anyway...
Type of knitting.
Is it?
Yeah. Oh. They released an album earlier this year called And, but this new single
which
I approved...
Which is also a stupid name.
Well, their first album was called The.
Well, that's also a stupid name.
Anyway!
These people win the Stupid Names of the Week
it
prize.
It doesn't matter because...
Matt's doing a jingle as we speak.
This single, Pork Ginger, which you might also say is not the greatest name, is not on that album.
It's not on The or And.
It's not on The or And. It's a standalone single released to mark the end of their first US tour.
Well, that's good.
Do you think they might release a single at the start of their first US tour? But no, the end. That's the place where you release singles.
It is.
They have quite a, as I said, they're math rock. They have quite a technical guitar sound, very frantic drums, which is always fun, but then quite poppy vocals that sort of tempers all that. It's very nice. As much as you clearly dislike them, based on nothing, names, their music is very good.
I sort of tuned out there because I'm trying to work out how I said Kelly Lee Owens wrong.
Oh, I'm not even going to explain it to you.
I think you were lying when you said
I may have been lying a little bit.
Two of these pronounced wrongly. Anyway, tell us about Kelly Lee Owens.
Kelly Lee Owens is a... Well, she's released two singles this year. Not really, not anything new. She's sort of, you know, she's someone I'm just approving because I've literally just discovered her. Although the tag here, she's got a gig coming up, but actually her music's been out for a little while.
I did see, was this not the one where one person tweeted to the effect of, why are you only approving her now?
Well, that was a stupid tweet.
We're not accepting that criticism.
No, I'm not, because the tweet was basically like, oh, well, I've liked her for years. It's like, what? So I shouldn't be like, so everyone has now heard of her and I shouldn't write about her. No, she's still pretty much unknown and should be heard by more people.
Okay.
Which is why I wrote about her.
Good.
Just stupid people on
with
Twitter.
With her exciting and fresh electronic sound.
Yes. Anyway, you might know her. As I even noted in the thing, 2 years ago she was quite heavily featured on a Daniel Avery album because she used to work with Daniel Avery in a record shop. And that is how they met. And so she was on his debut album. But yes, she's been making music for a while. She's released some singles. They're good. You should listen to them. Lucid and Uncertain.
You mentioned a gig.
She's got a gig supporting Jaco Aino Kalevi on the 18th of November at Electroworks in Islington.
So, Club 8.
Club 8. They're a Swedish duo, indie pop duo, who are currently celebrating their 20th anniversary with what they're releasing, what I think I'm right in saying, is their 9th album this month.
It better be right, because that's what you put in the CMU Daily.
Good, because I haven't put it in my notes
yet. And
we
wouldn't have an error in the CMU Daily.
It is their 9th album, then. It's called Pleasure. It's out on the 20th of November. This is the first single from it. It's called Late Nights. It's good. So their last album sort of saw them veer off a bit in terms of sound. They started producing more sort of retro electronic music. I found from the press release around their last album, they were using a 13-year-old copy of Cubase software. So now that, I guess, is not sure how long ago that was, but it's now more than 15-year-old Cubase software. So that's something to look out for. Although I would say that their music has quite a classic, timeless feel. You couldn't quite place it. Sounds both modern and old at the same time.
Well, that's really useful. Thanks for that description.
Good, isn't it?
I can now hear it in my mind.
It's like 80s pop, but modern.
Finally, this is a compilation that you're approving.
Yes.
Jupiter Sounds, Volume 1.
Yes, Jupiter Sounds.
It's a new label.
Volume 1. Jupiter Sounds is a new label founded by John Stuckey, who is a sound engineer.
Or Jean Stuckey.
Don't be silly. He's a sound engineer and producer. He makes music under the name Red Pine. He features on this compilation. But he set up this new label, which aims to uncover the finest in analog synth soundtrack and cosmic disco, which is something worth doing, as is proved by the quality of the music on this compilation he has released to launch the label. It was released the 5th of November, which is today as we're recording this, but not as you're listening. So all you need to know is it's out now. You can listen to the whole thing on SoundCloud. So do that.
CompleteMusicUpdate.com/approved is a domain via which you could find out more.
I think it's pronounced complete music.
Yeah, I think it's time to end that.
Okay. UK music's got its calculator out again. In fact, I'm sure you all watched me talking about this on Channel 5 News on Thursday.
I didn't.
No, because you were recording a podcast at the time.
I get my news from a proper source, not Channel 5 News. So I didn't see it, unfortunately. But I'm sure...
I was going to say people didn't need us to go over this again.
It was very informative.
They got a very informative insight from me already. But we can talk about it if you want.
So when you talked about this on Channel 5 News,
They
wouldn't let you mention the names of any artists.
No.
Which is a bit weird.
No, it made it quite difficult to talk about.
So every year, UK Music, which is the trade body of trade bodies in the music industry, because the music industry, for some reason, needs 17
it's lobbying organisation
trade bodies. So UK Music brings together all the different bits of the music industry. So recordings, is that even recordings?
You pronounced that wrong.
Records, the record industry, publishing, live, management, etc., etc., etc. And basically, this report tries to quantify the economic impact that the music industry has on the wider UK economy. The term is gross value added, which apparently, if you're an economics type of person, that makes sense. You know what that means?
It's sort of it's the revenues after you've deducted business costs, basically.
You're saying with your business degree?
Yeah. To be honest, I have a business A-level and a business degree, and I never understood value added.
And so, this is gross value added. So.
And this is gross value added, so it makes it harder.
So or even if you don't understand the exact way in which these are calculated, and even if Andy, despite his vast business qualifications, isn't able to explain it to you, all you really need to know is how things are going up and going down from this year's survey versus last year's survey. And basically, things are up.
It's all great. In fact, the economic impact of UK music is up 5%, or what it was in 2014.
It
might be down again now.
These are 2014 figures. And, I mean, amongst the various stats, which I'm sure Andy Malt will run you through very shortly, having already had a dress rehearsal on the Channel 5 News about this, international is a big part of this. You know, one of the reasons why the UK music industry is doing very well at the moment is because, obviously, we're selling a lot of music within the UK itself. But we have had, and obviously we're not allowed to mention One Direction. We're not allowed to mention
Ed Sheeran
or Sam Smith or
Calvin Harris.
All those
Ellie Goulding,
the upstarts,
Pink Floyd were a big one.
Yeah, bit of new talent there, doing well around the world. And so British music is selling very well worldwide on CD download and streaming, etc., etc.
Ed Sheeran.
That's one of you've already said Ed Sheeran.
Oh, did I?
It was the first one you said. So, and you pronounced it the same both times.
Ed Sheeran.
So these are all artists that are doing very well internationally, and that is one of the reasons why UK music is doing very well, by which I mean the UK music industry and not UK music, the body that did the maths. Tell us some of the other stats in the Measuring Music report.
Well, the gross value added to the UK economy of music in the UK is £4.1 billion.
As you say, 5% higher than 2013, when it was £3.8 billion.
Yeah, rubbish.
I actually did the maths. I actually added up the various figures in the chart.
Yeah.
And it's actually slightly below 4.1 billion. They did a little sneaky rounding up there. I think it was 4.056 billion or something like that.
Oh, so, well, I mean...
Bit of a cheat. Other figures?
Other figures. Well, the bulk of the money, they reckoned, was generated by creators specifically. So musicians, songwriters, composers, lyricists, people involved in recording. It wasn't quite clear about whether they meant studio people or just because artists record stuff.
And of course,
one of the many vagaries of this report.
That was the group of people who are constantly banging on about how broke they are.
Yes.
But it may well be that
they've got £1.9 billion.
Perhaps if you take Ed Sheeran and Sam Smith from One Direction and Pink Floyd out of the equation, you're left with about 80p before everyone else.
They don't have £1.9 billion.
They have generated
it for the UK, and they should be happy with that because there are 117,000 people in full-time jobs in the UK music industry, according to this report.
Given there are
most of whom are involved in creating music.
Given that a lot of people who work in music are part-time, they have other ways of making money, I wonder if they are not included in that figure or whether they all get added together. So they're I mean, I suppose a lot of musicians don't make a full-time living out of their music, but then the other stuff they do is sort of in music. So they have your education or a bit of PR or a bit of whatever. So perhaps they then classify them as full-time jobs. I have no idea how they work that out. One of these days, I'm going to go into UK music and I'm going to get each of these figures and I'm going to point at them and say, explain to me how you work this out. But I haven't done that yet, so we'll just have to go with the stats as if they're for definite.
Well, the music rights sector, that's the biggest bit of this. Recordings worth £615 million, publishing worth £410 million.
So between them, the copyright side of music industry generating over £1 billion. The live sector...
The live sector was the biggest growth area.
And it's now just under £1 billion, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
And it's interesting. I mean, the live industry, obviously what we have seen over the last, well, certainly between 2000 and 2010, was that the record industry was going down, down, down. The live industry was going up, up, up. And I know the live industry likes to say, we're bigger than the record industry. And it's like, well, yeah, you are bigger than the record industry, but you're not bigger than the music rights industry. If you put the song copyrights in with the recording copyrights. Although, actually, they are getting quite close.
They are getting quite close.
So it may well be that this year, having said that, I mean... Adele is going to have a big impact on these figures next time round.
Yes.
And this set of figures, 2015, will only have Adele's recordings because she's not... I can't believe she's going on tour this side of Christmas because she hasn't announced anything yet, has she? So it may well be that that skews things in the sort of the record publishing industry's favour.
Yes. Though, the reason these figures are up is that 2014 had a lot of big album releases. You had Sam Smith, you had Ed Sheeran, you had Calvin Harris, you had Pink Floyd in their final album. And you had One Direction. Now, One Direction will be a sizable chunk of this money. But their release, like Adele's, came right at the end of the year. But One Direction are a band who hit the Christmas market quite hard. As I think Adele probably will as well. So there will be a sizable chunk of money in these figures next year.
But you're thinking
Adele.
That other than Adele, there haven't been as many big releases this year from UK artists. Is that what you're thinking?
I don't think there's quite the cluster that there were in 2014. I mean, Coldplay have apparently got an album coming out.
This side of Christmas.
This side of Christmas. So that will generate some money. But I think in terms of clusters of big UK artists who are also big internationally, like 2014 was quite an unusual year.
So, music people, brace yourself for a slide next year, Andy Malt is predicting, in the 2015
that.
Figures.
I didn't say that. I think, I mean, Adele, like you say, will have a big, big impact. And she'll have a big impact on the next year's figures as
Indeed.
Well.
Indeed. Particularly assuming she goes on tour, which is what we're expecting.
Yes. Yeah, so when the 2016 figures come out in 2017, I think we'll see more Adele effect. I mean, if this album's anything like the last Adele album, it'll roll on into the following year's figures as well.
It will, although I think what will happen this time is there will be a massive spike on launch in the way there wasn't with the last album.
True.
But there then won't be the long tail in quite the same way. Although, obviously, the streaming market, I mean, Ed Sheeran is still bringing in good money this far on from his album release because of the streaming market, because he has a big following in sort of the streaming users, rather than having the big first week spike that you would traditionally have from an artist like that. He's seeing the money coming in from a longer period of time.
Yeah, so you could say, yeah, I mean, Ed Sheeran will have an effect on this year. And I suppose Sam Smith continues to do well. So you could start to see the longevity of these artists at least sustaining the level of these figures.
Yes, because the streaming money comes in over a much longer period of time.
But what even is the point of these figures? Why does UK Music do this report every bloody year?
Because they knew that this was a quiet news week, and before the Pandora announcement it was a very quiet news week, and that we were going to need something to fill 8 minutes of our podcast. That's the entire reason they do it. In fact, if you read the little letters at the start of the report, you know, introducing it, that's pretty much what they say. So it exists entirely for us to pad out our podcast in a quiet newsweek.
Might there be another reason?
It's possible. You mentioned UK Music ultimately is a lobbying organisation, so represents the music industry to government on the odd occasion that the music industry agrees on something and goes and lobbies. So really, this is, and they've been, I think this is the third edition of this report that they've done, or maybe the fourth.
No, it's the third.
It's to go to government and say, look how important we are, look at all the people we employ, look at all the money we generate. We're way ahead of loads of other sectors in terms of growth. Hey, John Whittingdale, culture secretary, minister, dude, help us, be nice to us. We're really important. It's basically...
Yes, and as you say, I think it's something that it's very easy for the music industry to agree on as a whole, is that it's very important and should be left alone by government and or given tax breaks and generally supported.
And crack down on piracy. Pump another million into Get It Right from a freaking genuine site and other stupid things like that. So yeah, a great report, great figures. Expect more government-led nonsense supporting the music industry in years to come.
Especially as John Whittingdale is quite happy to wander around pretending that people in the music industry are his mates.
Indeed. So
He loves it.
So yeah, the report is free. It's available on UK Music's website. If you're a fan of bar charts and pie charts...
And who isn't?
Knock yourself out.
It may have been a slow news week, as you said, but there are still a few things that could have been considered for further discussion on this podcast that were ultimately rejected. And here they are in a list form.
I mean, actually, the biggest news story this week, probably, I mean, the Pandora deal is quite big, is the fire in the club in Bucharest.
Yes.
And we haven't really talked about that on the podcast because it's you know, we're quite lighthearted and sarcastic on this podcast. It doesn't seem appropriate. But a club venue in the Romanian capital, a horrible fire last weekend. 32 people were killed in it. But it's also it started a really interesting debate about health and safety. We've seen fires like this in clubs elsewhere in the world before, and it's always because of pyrotechnics in clubs that should never have pyrotechnics, flammable soundproofing, rubbish emergency exits. They're all obvious things, and we've seen this happen in various clubs around the world. But it's particularly interesting because I think the big allegation behind all of this is the health and safety law is there in Romania. It's just that there's a lot of corruption, and health and safety officers are taking bribes to not enforce the law.
I mean, various other club owners came out immediately after the fire and said, do you know what, this could have happened in our club and we should probably sort this out. I think what started as a kind of march in remembrance of the dead, which, I mean, included two members of the band who were performing, it turned into a protest against the kind of the slack enforcement of health and safety laws in Romania. And ultimately, this fire happened on a Friday, and by Tuesday, the Prime Minister had resigned.
Indeed.
So it's had a big effect.
And it's an ongoing story because the Prime Minister was already caught up in a corruption scandal and faces charges and stuff like that. But it seems to have been sort of a catalyst in Romanian people have been getting angrier and angrier about corruption in government and things like that. And then this is sort of built around this one incident. And, well, hopefully it will result in changes that means that this can never happen again in Romania. And whenever this happens in a country, generally speaking, there is then quite a big crackdown, and you hope that it couldn't happen twice in one country. But also you hope that people learn beyond.
Yeah.
This is the sort of thing that you shouldn't say because you're tempting fate, but... Generally speaking, as I see it, health and safety of venues in this country is almost the best in the world. And I know that other countries do come to this country to learn from our sector. And, you know, in the live sector, you moan about bloody health and safety, stopping us doing this, stopping us doing that. But I think it's stories like this that make you realise, however irritating health and safety may be, and sometimes councils enforce it too highly, But it's there for a reason. And so a very sad story this week, which we're not going to give it too much discussion to, but it's definitely one to follow. Meanwhile, on our list of things, also run story one-liners.
Yeah, so there's another lawsuit being launched against SFX over Robert Silliman's failed buyback plan.
I sense that this is law firms sort of fishing for
it
work.
It does seem to be like it's law firms setting up a class action lawsuit with no one involved and then going, maybe you would like to come and get some money.
But there are now three law firms who are basically saying that SFX and or Robert Silliman gave out misleading statements during the whole buyback thing that was ultimately abandoned. So, yes, another bit of SFX news to follow.
Ministry of Sound, noted for its dislike of streaming services, has launched its own streaming service.
Well, it's more of a radio service.
Yeah, it is more of an online radio service where they'll have various shows. They'll be streaming, I think, their Friday and Saturday night club nights for people who can't get out and would rather sit in their living room
and listen to the loud, noisy club music outside of a club environment. I mean, Ministry have had online things like this before, but there's a bespoke app, isn't there, that this will be coming through?
Yes. I mean, there's obviously that. I mean, Boiler Room does exactly that. So it's not a new thing in club-based music, but it's interesting that Ministry of Sound are doing it.
And then Ministry of Sound are still open.
Yes, because talking of
South London venue.
South London venues, the Coronet is going to close in 2017. In fact, it was supposed to be closing like now, this month, but they've managed to negotiate another year. They had a campaign to keep it open long term, but that has failed. But they have managed to negotiate with their landlords one more year of the Coronet, which will take it to January the 5th, 2017.
And obviously it's part of the ongoing story, the gentrification of London, the area, Elephant and Castle, where it's based, is all being redeveloped. There's no room for this venue. But, I mean, of all the venues that have shut, it's like, what, 100 and will be 140 years old when it...
Yeah, it was, I think, it's so rigid. There was another venue there, the Theatre Royal, opened in, I think, 1892, and then promptly burnt down. And the Coronet was built on the site of that venue in about 1892. It must be 1895 or 6. But at the time it closes in January 2017, it will have been open for 138 years, and now it's being shut down so that they can bulldoze it and build, I don't know, another Pret or something.
Or more overpriced apartment blocks that only 9 people in the world can afford. Anyway, another venue dead.
Great
in
stuff.
London. But they've got this extra year and they're just going to have a massive closing down party that will run pretty much a 12 month solid. So everyone should try.
They were putting a very a positive spin on it.
So
that's nice.
There you go.
CDs. Everyone's still playing them in their cars. That's what some research found.
Yeah, BPI and the Entertainment Retail Association put out a bit of research about in-car entertainment, basically saying that as it currently stands, I think 80% of cars still have CD players in it. I mean, actually, the research was the other way around. 20% of cars don't have CD players because of the rise of in digital entertainment systems, blah, blah, blah. But the new story there surely is that 80% of new cars, not used cars, new cars still have CD players in them. So I think, and it's interesting because, you know, CD sales in this country, they're in decline, but they're still pretty strong. And I have a suspicion a big part of that is in-car listening. People are buying CDs, playing the car. And most cars that you are buying at the moment, certainly used cars and new cars, will have a CD player in. Although they reckon that by, 2021, in 5 years' time, five, 6 years' time, we'll reach a point where more new cars are being sold without CD players than with them. But that's still 5 years of new cars going out onto the roads with little slots into which to insert music discs to play. So, interesting.
And finally, on our little list of things we didn't talk about, NWA's manager is suing over his portrayal in Straight Outta Compton.
Neither of us have seen this movie.
No, but I do understand that he comes off quite badly in it. And, I mean, I believe that the movie is mainly about NWA's gripes over contract negotiations.
Yeah, there was who did you say reviewed it?
Mark Kermode. He didn't understand why, rather than making a film about the culture of the time and the wider things that were going on around NWA, they just made a film about contract negotiations.
And the former manager of the group is not happy and he's suing for various things, but apparently there was an agreement a long time ago.
1999, they had a settlement.
So Dre and all the other ex-members of the group, do we call them a group?
Yes.
They're a group, not a band, because
they're
hip-hop.
Call them a band if you want.
They're not a band, they're a group.
Band.
All the other members of the hip-hop outfit.
Band.
Said, we'll never diss you in public. I don't know if that sort of contract has an agreement, a non-disagreement, an NDA. And so they're basically saying that this is a breach of contract. But there were, it was one of those classic lawsuits where there was a number of things that he was claiming. And it was a ridiculous sum of money.
Oh, yeah, it was a huge amount of money. Over $100 million, I think. And various, I mean, clearly throwing a lot of things at the wall in the hope that something would stick. So he brought up this non-disagreement. He brought up the fact that he, while still on good, better terms with the band, had worked on a couple of screenplays that didn't become the film, but at least one of which had been called Straight Outta Compton, and was claiming that the final script that was made into a film was based on a script that he'd worked on, though presumably not the bits of it where he comes off really badly.
the handful of scenes where he doesn't come off as being the bad guy.
And he was saying that they misused his image rights. Because he wasn't consulted beforehand, he didn't approve his appearance in the film. He denied that he was eating lobster instead of finalising agreements for the band. There were many things. Whether this ever comes to anything, who knows?
I mean, we say this all the time on the podcast that this probably won't go to court, but I wish it would. And I think in this case, I really wish it would. It would be great to have all of these arguments out in court. In fact, that would probably be more interesting than the film. There would then be a Straight Outta Compton 2 could be a film version of the court case. But it will probably either fizzle out or get settled. Who knows? But Bieber!
Yeah, let's finish this thing on some Bieber. Because I know people like it. It's been a big week for Bieber. Because he's obviously... he's cranking into action for the release of his new album. He's coming back. He's on the other side of his troubles, the Bieber troubles. Now, as we regularly point out in the CMU Daily, he is the world's greatest human being. This was confirmed this week, sort of, in a letter. It turns out we reported a few months ago that although he'd been sentenced to do some community service because he threw some eggs at his neighbour's house.
This was from the Egg Croak. So during his sort of, when he was just getting into trouble every day of the week.
Yeah, what seemed like one of the more mild court cases he got involved in, though, I mean, he caused a lot of damage to his neighbour's house.
With these eggs. And so, a few months ago, the story was, even though he's apparently reformed and he's a good guy now, he still hasn't done his community service. Hey, Bieber, do your community service. Go and pick up some litter. Or do something useful.
But now he has done it. He went and worked for Volunteers of America.
Who were really impressed with
worked
him.
Worked in two of their centres. They were really impressed with him. And TMZ got hold of a letter from a rep from Volunteers of America saying, I truly believe he has learned his lesson and will be a proactive member of society and a great human being. Didn't quite say the world's greatest human being is what he is at this very moment.
But got very close.
Even though we all know that. But I mean... This is being submitted to court. Maybe he was a little bit wary of making too bold a statement, even if it is a fact.
But and the court saw what they were really saying because the parole is over.
Yeah, he was on 2 years parole. He's 15 months into it, but now they went, you don't need to be on parole anymore. You are the world's greatest human being.
So
go forth and promote your new album.
That part of Bieber's life is now well behind him. One would hope that everyone has managed to block that photo that was doing the rounds last month. That's now out of people's minds. But so what else has been happening in the world of Bieber this week?
Well, he went out on the promotional trail to promote his new album. And frankly, he messed it up. He was in Oslo in Norway. He was doing a TV record. So it's a small show in front of 1,000 fans for TV where he was supposed to play 4 or 5 songs. And he came on and he played the first song. And then he noticed at the front of the stage, someone had spilt some water. And he thought, ooh, someone could slip on that, even though it's on a part of the stage that no one would ever stand on. Someone could slip and break their neck.
TV studio, there are electrics.
Yes. And it's like, we don't want that.
So he's being a responsible
because
guy.
Because he's such a great guy, he was like, I'm just going to go and clean that up. It's a TV pre-record. They can edit all this together. It doesn't matter. I'll just go and mop it up with this towel.
So this sounds like a responsible guy. So how is this a mess up?
Well, he wandered to the front of the stage and he started trying to clean it up. And being right at the front of the stage, there were a lot of fans there too. And they started like grabbing at him as they might. And he was all like, oh, don't grab at me. I'm just trying to mop up this water here. And then he had a little bit of shouting at them saying, you're not listening to me. And they still grabbed him. In fact, there was one point, there's a video of this, which I don't know. he said, "Are you listening to me?" And one person shouts, "Yes." And the others are still grabbing at him. And then he just goes, "Right, that's it. I'm not doing the show," and walks off. This all happens in the space of about 8 seconds. And the speed with which it happens sort of makes it look like he decided he wasn't going to do the show before he went to mop up the water.
And your allegation here...
That's some speculation on my part.
That is controversial speculation. It does, because he was being a responsible guy here.
Well, we all know...
And you're trying to make it... Not only did he shout at his fans, but he didn't want to perform at all.
I think he might have been using the fact that we all know what a responsible and brilliant human being he is now. And as a result... kind of used that to toy with us, when in fact he just didn't want to play this show.
But he very quickly repented for this slight blip, because obviously this is not how Bieber is these days. A year ago, it would have been, "Oh, that's Bieber. But this is not how he behaves now, and he was very quick to sort of apologise.
Well, he posted on Instagram, he said, "Sadly, it's been a rough week for me. Long days, no sleep, while having to be on, as they would say, for cameras, fans, etc. In no way did I mean to come across as mean, but chose to end the show as the people in the front row would not listen. Hopefully people will understand where I'm coming from."
So I think that the moral of this story is Bieber is the greatest guy in the world.
His fans are fucking idiots.
Yeah, I think that probably is.
And he hates them all, especially ones in the front row.
Well, you know, if you're the greatest person in the world and you've got those fans, you'd have to hate your fans, wouldn't you? It was interesting that this story was sort of then spun by, the media.
Ugh.
It was very much spun as if this was like a full-on gig that he'd stormed off stage, not a TV record. And he'd already done one song, so presumably they could use the one song.
Yes.
So it was sort of presented as being, "Oh, he's back in his old ways, he's pissing off people at big concerts." And it's like, I mean, okay, perhaps he shouldn't have done it, but it's a bit different walking off a TV record than it would be walking out of a full-on
gig. He didn't leave a stadium. That would be quite different.
So there you go. That's the latest batch of Bieber news wrapping up this edition of the CMU podcast. You should probably do that bit that you do at the end.
Yeah. What would you like Justin Bieber to clean up for you? I already regret asking that question, but why don't you answer it at CMU on Twitter?
Yeah, tweet us that.
And then before you do that, do please ensure that you have hit the subscribe button on this podcast, wherever you're listening to it, so that you can get it automatically every week and you can get more nonsense Bieber news delivered right into your ears.
And who knows, UK music might do some more maths, so we might have some more stats
for you. Yeah, there could be some more maths. Everyone likes maths.
And if you're a Kim.com legal story fan, then I think you're going to be pleased with next week's podcast. So,
and who knows what unprecedented deals Pandora will do in the weeks to come.
Yes. Following that precedent, there will be more unprecedented precedents.
Yes.
So stay tuned, subscribe.
Yes. This podcast, It Just Remains Me to Tell You, was presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It was produced by Matt Peaty. And if you want to have some more stuff from CMU, you'll find it all on completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
I'm just wondering whether there's any other Bieber news, but there isn't.
Not this week.